Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 12th, 1999. We are in the fireside room this morning. Your presenter is Luther Snow. Today's session number is 99-3 and is titled Place-Based Action. Let's listen in.
You have been to one of these before. Raise your hand. Okay, good. So I'll give a brief introduction for the rest of you. My name is Luther Snow, and I'm a community economic development consultant, born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and that's really where I sort of cut my teeth in community organizing and development and activism. Some of you have heard of Bethel New Life because it's the biggest community development corporation coming out of a Lutheran church in the world, I guess. And I was the first director of economic development there, working in a low-income African-American community on the west side of Chicago, where we did things like build the first housing that had been built in 30 years and sponsor the first Habitat chapter that had ever been come to Chicago or ever gone north or the south, and a recycling center and sewing co-ops and so forth. And I went on to organize and manage coalitions of grassroots community groups. There's so many communities in Chicago that we have to have coalitions of community groups to act together and to get things done, so that's in a sense a coalition of coalitions, if you will. And I found over the years that people would look at me and hear what I do and look at me kind of sideways and say, boy, you know, I really can't even imagine being able to stand on a corner in West Garfield Park, let alone creating new employment opportunities from the sweat equity of the people who live there. And the question that they would always ask me, whether it was bank executives or my peers and colleagues and friends or people in a church group where we go to sell affordable housing investments, would be, can you make a difference? Would it really work? Does it really work? And of course, you know, when you're selling the limited partnership shares, the answer is yes. And when they say, how can we help, you say, make your check out too. And that's a good answer, but you know, it always struck me as kind of funny because even from when I was 18 and organizing my first rent strike in a low income, well, in a slum, in my own community, and they cut off the gas in the building, and older people were, you know, they were going to get ready to die if they didn't have hot baths once a day, five times a day. And the answer that the people said, you know, there was a lot of discussion in the room, should we withhold our rent to make a change in the way the slumlord is exploiting this building? And you know, you can be punished, you can be evicted, you can lose your home. And so there's a lot of power to go up against there. And the answer was always, well, what choice do we have, really? We've got to act. The risk of inaction is greater than the risk of action. But as I began to think about it, I began to think, well, really this question of can we make change and how is really central, and not just to community economic development, but to so much of what we do in our lives. And I began to see how the status quo perpetuates itself in cycles that go around and around. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer, or the strong benefit from the status quo and the weak suffer from it. And whether that was in families, or whether that was in art, or whether that's in natural selection, or whether that's in the origin of the universe, or whether that was in community economic development, I saw those cycles. And we've talked a lot this week about some different cycles, and I've got lots of examples. I take them from different places. Let me just mention a couple here so you get a flavor of it. I cut an article out of the New York Times called the Hotel Motel Cartel. Have you seen this one? Yeah. You see that one? Yeah. Was that good? And it's basically, why are all the motels owned by Indians, Indians, right, from India? And they're all named Patel. So. And it told a story, basically, about how one immigrant to this country, I think it was in San Francisco, came, and the opportunity presented itself to buy a hotel, and then their brother came, and so what should they do but do that, and they could kind of share resources. And over time, it was a minority, it was excluded from this majority motel-owning network in the country. So they banded together and they shared resources and information. And when a hotel went up for sale, they shared that information with each other. And so pretty much, then people started to say, well, you know, if you want to sell your hotel, a good thing to do would be to contact the Potel Motel Cartel. And so then they started to get all the offers, and they would be able to, you know, do group purchasing and buying resources and that sort of thing. And now the president of the National American Hotel Motel Owners Association is Potel. And so they kind of spun a cycle out of a cycle of privilege and exclusion into a cycle of cooperation and prosperity, at least for Indians. And now they say that similar kinds of cycles are happening in other parts of the countries with Pakistanis and Koreans and so forth. So that's just to give you an example of this. Today we're going to talk about place, physical place, ruralness, urbanness, and suburbanness, and cycles of perpetuation of the status quo according to place, according to land and property, but also according to how community organizes itself in place. And hopefully we'll be able to use that as a way of trying to apply this model of thinking about breaking out of cycles and how to create positive cycles to replace negative cycles in all aspects of life. So even though we're talking about place, we hope that we'll learn something that will apply to families and individuals and art and science and nature as well. Okay? All right, now I'm going to get you up off your feet. I would like, let's say, five people, the first five here, to wait for a bus. All right, here's the bus stop. The bus might pull up anywhere between this chair and that chair. So I want you to wait for a bus there. Then I want, on this side of the room, let's just say you bunch of people, whoever you are, to come over here and pretend that it's a cold day and that is a furnace. Together to get one, right? That's urbanness. And then Mark tries to be on this side so he can run over to get to the bus. That's what you all were supposed to do. That's suburbanness.
But we're supposed to go.
You were supposed to take advantage of that warmth over there. Maybe I put it too far away.
But some rural people don't like crowds.
Well, absolutely. Spread outness is the deal.
We're rural.
But I was turning you into suburbanites.
Yeah.
So your idea would be to try to get as much warmth from this as you could.
That's too many people.
And still be able to catch the bus.
Too many people.
So where would you be? You'd be in
between. Too many people.
I got excited. That's nice.
Okay, go back and get your seats, people. I moved from inner city Chicago to rural Decorah, Iowa. I had never lived outside of a city of less than 5 million people before that. So it was a big change to me. So I've given a lot of thought to the difference between rural and urban and suburban. Boy, there's a lot of stereotypes, and there's a lot of biases, and there's a lot of subjectivity in terms of what it's like. And I was stunned, really, when I moved to Decorah to hear some of the perspectives that people had about the city. And to be fair, in Chicago, people didn't really even express perspectives about the country, unless it was to say, wouldn't that be nice? Boy, someday I'd love to go live in a small town somewhere where I didn't have to deal with the hustle and the bustle and that sort of thing. In the rural areas, there is a real anti-city kind of a thing. I remember a zoning issue came up. They were going to have zoning for the first time in the city. And letters to the editor were written to the extent that this was a plot by city people to get us. And I thought, I haven't met any city people here. And even if there were, why would they care about zoning out here in rural Iowa? Well, it turned out what they meant was the people who live in this small town of 8,000 people were the city people, and the people who live outside it, they're the country folk. And to the extent that Decorah is this, outside Decorah is that, that's right. From that perspective, from a national perspective, that's nuts. From a national perspective, what's happening to ruralness and urbanness and suburbanness? Used to be, just 20 years ago, it was about one-third each in terms of population. One-third of the country lived in rural areas. Towns of 25,000 or less. Now, Decorah is 8, right? So we're not anywhere near. About a third lived in the suburbs, and about a third lived in the urban central cities. Okay? Be careful there. Now, it's more like 45 suburbs, and 20 rural, and 25 in the central cities. This is reflected in the politics of state governments, especially. State politicians have always made power by setting different parts of the populations against each other. So the rural politicians will say, we got to get together and beat whatever that thing is that upstate wants to do, or the city part of the state wants to do, and then vice versa. It would come out as racism. Come out as classes, come out as people against people. Interesting thing now is that where rural folks and city folks have always kind of butted heads against each other, in some sense, in a larger sense that I think that's often missing, rural and urban folks have much more in common in this new dynamic where the majority is suburban than they have to keep us apart. And that, I thought, was something interesting to share with you all here today. Let me talk about land and place as a cycle. By the way, show of hands, those people live in a town of 25,000 or less. Oh, all you Decorah people. Okay, those of you who live in a central city.
How big is a city?
Well, is it the center of a metropolitan area?
Yeah.
It's a central city. Okay, and all those living in the suburbs?
Suburbs.
So what's our percentage like here?
45.
How do we come out compared to the national average? All right, do it again.
Yeah.
All those rural country folk, raise your hand. By my definition, 25,000 or less.
11.
Thank you. All right, 11. All those city folks, central city, center of a metropolitan area. You raised your hand before, didn't you? You changed.
Well, the definition was the corrected.
Okay.
We're the center of a county, but it's still less than 5,000.
Okay, we'll get that, a rural regional center. We'll get to that in a second. Good. That's different. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then suburbs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Actually, we're in a micropolitan area.
Yeah.
You were there.
The Vikings train there, so that's
right. Yeah. Oh, it's a big city.
So you didn't know why to raise your hand, huh?
No.
Okay.
We're kind of this regional.
Right. And I think part of the point here, too, is that there's ruralness and urbanness and suburbanness where we live. So that's part of it. But it looks like our numbers kind of break down like the national average. Maybe a little fewer suburbs, a little more country, a little fewer central city. Okay. Let's see how a cycle works that perpetuates the status quo in the inner city. That's something I know a lot about and I love to talk about. You're going to have to make sure I stay on time here. I had to move here from the place next door, and in the process, I got all my stuff switched around. Here we go. Neighborhood change. Boy, can you read that? I can never get this thing really quite focused right. How's that? Not good on the bottom, good on the top. I got to choose.
That's good.
That's good. That's pretty.
Is that good enough? It's better than the other room. Chicago has such a strong history of neighborhoods. And immigration came in waves, and all the Italians would live in this community, and all the Irish would live in this community, and then there'd be another wave, and the Italians would move out further, and the Hispanics would come and live in this community, and of course, African-American migration from the South in the 20s and 30s and 40s had a huge impact. And there was white flight to the suburbs, and there was a big influx of all sorts of ethnic populations in the 70s and 80s. And so neighborhoods mean a lot in Chicago. If you say where you live in Chicago, absolutely people, you want to say, well, I live in Hyde Park, or I live in South Shore, I live in a neighborhood. A neighborhood would have anywhere from 30,000 to 80,000 people in it, and that's a small community. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at the way neighborhoods develop as places over time in a city like Chicago, and I think it's mirrored in other cities, there is a cycle that goes on. And in this cycle, poor people lose out at every step of the process, and the already privileged benefit from it. So let's have a look at it. Where does it start? Up here. Let's start up here. It could start anywhere in the cycle. A new community is built, and it's built as kind of an enclave. It's built as a kind of a place, but people would say community, right? They would say, this is where the Irish live, and it's Bridgeport, and this is where Mayor Daley lives, and this is where the ward bosses live, and this is where the precinct is. This is where you can get Irish whiskey down at the bar, and this is where our culture is, and this is where our people are. So there are good reasons for it. It's built as an enclave in the sense that there are strong physical territorial markations about where this community ends. It ends at the park. It ends at the tracks. Other side of the tracks, right? Right? Heard that many times. So it starts as a kind of an enclave. And then, in this model, we've got an external change. Something happens outside of the system. And that could be massive in-migration of African Americans, say, from the South, who need a place to live. And so the working class housing in the city is located in these certain neighborhoods, and so naturally the place to go would be where the working class housing is located. That's one environmental change. A big other one is the car. The car meant that people could drive further to go shopping, and so Main Street started to get emptied and the malls started to get filled up on the outside of town. I'll talk about that in a sec. So because of this environmental change, then, people react, and the community starts to tip. Now, how does this happen? The privileged use their privileges to get more privilege out of the change. So the big thing in the 60s and the early 70s in Chicago was called blockbusting. Anybody know what blockbusting is? Basically, real estate brokers and speculators would use racial change as a way to make money. What they would do is they'd go to, they'd find the border between where the African Americans live and where the whites live. And they would go across the street into the white community. And they would say to the white people, basically, the niggers are coming. And you know what happens when the niggers come. Look at how the housing goes down. Look at how the property values go down. It gets to be a mess. Your property value will go down. You better get out first. So you leave. I'll take it off your hands. But I'm not going to be able to give you what you used to get for it because, you know, property values are going to go down, right? So I'm going to buy it from you cheap, okay? Then they would go back over to the African-American community and say, wouldn't you like to step up in life? Wouldn't you like to move up to another community where, you know, the lawns are mowed and the trash is picked up and also the ward committeeman pays attention to your desires and needs as a political representative. And then they would say, wouldn't you like to buy into this community? Of course, it's going to cost a little extra, isn't it? Right? So they would speculate on the property, and they'd buy the property when it was low, when the scare was in, and they would create the scare to make it be low. And then they would sell it to the outsiders so that they could move in. And they would call that process tipping. And in Chicago, many people began to believe it was almost natural, as if African Americans moving in meant the community would go down because of something about the way African Americans live or something like that. But really what it was an economic strategy, not really that much different from how many people had Bible study this morning. Not really much different from the tax collectors. Buy high, sell low, exploit the difference, right? And set the people against each other to make that happen. So then what would happen is, as a community got tipped, people would bail out. People would bail out, institutions would bail out, banks would bail out. They would continue to accept deposits from the people in those communities, but they wouldn't make loans to people in those communities. Insurance companies would bail out. They wouldn't even offer insurance in those areas, and they call that redlining. Redline means the line that they drew around the geographic boundary of that community to say where it is that we will sell insurance and where we won't, and we won't within the red line. Institutions would bail out. Churches left. Our people, what do you do now? You're a congregation. You have a building and a place and a facility and a history and a community and a culture and so forth. All your people move out. And they move 30 blocks west, and then later on they move to the nearest suburb or whatever. What do you do? Do you follow them? Does the congregation go with the people, or does it stay with the place? Which would you do? I mean, it's not an easy question. I guess that's why I put it that way. But what most all the churches did was left. They closed the church in the city, and then they opened up. They built a new building somewhere else, right? Shuttered it up. Bethel New Life was different. Bethel New Life stayed and said, our congregation is the people who live here. And that's why we've got an African-American Lutheran congregation in the middle of the city of Chicago. Not the only one, but one of the only ones. Okay, so disinvestment. Not bad personal habits, but disinvestment causes the movement from the tipping to the slum. Okay? And because there's not this slumlord, I don't want to talk about the rent strike. The slumlord takes the rent and doesn't put money back into the building. That's how they make money at that side of the scale. So no wonder the property goes down. The roads are disrepaired. The trash isn't picked up. And meanwhile, over there in the privileged community, all those things are happening, so they look much better over there. All right, but that's not the end of the cycle. Could be years. Could be 20 years in this condition, in a disinvested community, okay? What people call a bad neighborhood, okay? But then something else happens, and that's the cycle of gentrification. That's the replacement half of this curve, okay? Gentrification happens because the land values are cheap in this community. Oftentimes, the amenities of the community, the intrinsic amenities of the community, location near Lake Michigan, near the park, the historic character of the buildings, are still really high. And so somebody figures out, I can buy low and sell high again. right? Because what I can do is buy slums and buy vacant land in a slum, right? And then I can get the government, another external actor here from this perspective, to invest in slum rehabilitation. They're going to make the slums better. That sounds good, right? And I can get public money for that, right? So we're going to have a big new mixed-use real estate development out in Lawndale with a big movie theater and a grocery store. Won't that be great for the people? Won't that be great for the people? They will replace the physical plant, and then they will increase the property values. Well, increase the property values. Most poor people don't own property. They rent. So as the property values go up, rents go up. And now it's no longer an affordable place to live. And so you've got to get out. And the poor people get moved to another poor neighborhood, which is down at this end. So the poor people live here while the crime is high and while the government infrastructure and investment is at the lowest, basically when things are the worst. And when it starts to get good, you get to get out. What if you do own your home? The other thing that happens is oftentimes you'll have seniors, fixed incomes, property values go up, you think that'd be great for them, right? Their homes are increasing in value. But the other thing happens is property taxes go up, insurance goes up, the fixed costs go up. And so even a senior citizen who owns a home in a gentrifying community might get pushed out by the increased cost of living there, okay? So, after all that is done, we're back to what? An enclave. All right? What happened during this process? Wasted wealth. The cost of polarizing community development. Waste here, waste here, waste here, waste here. Okay? Beautiful buildings are built here that are disinvested and torn down. And man, I took a group of Luther College students out to the south side of Chicago this spring, and they just couldn't believe it looked like Germany after the war, man. It is bombed out, brick-strewn vacant lots, and two buildings per block, kind of thing. All that stuff got wasted. It could have been kept up. It could have been renewed and maintained, as it is in other places, but it wasn't. So that's $1 billion of loss, maybe $3 billion there. You've got loss of infrastructure. Probably the most difficult one is the social capital. When you move all the churches out, and you move all the social institutions out of a community, what does it take to rebuild that? We don't think of that as a financial asset. But yesterday we did the asset-based community development, and it was right up there on the chart, right? Well, what if you lose all those assets? What if they're wasted? They're no longer there anymore, and you've got to rebuild them. And people talk about economic opportunity not being there in the inner city because they don't have social networks, and they don't know somebody who is a manager at a business that's employing people. You know, your cousin isn't working at the plant where the job opening is posted. So that kind of social capital loss is also a waste of this cycle of polarizing community development. Business capital, factories get torn down. And the economic function. The community was there for a reason in the first place, and now it no longer has that function. They were the workers to the steel mills. Now they're not. It lost that economic function, and so it's not serving that anymore. And then 60,000 people moved around from here to here, an intangible loss of life and culture and racial tolerance and community. All right, so part of what this series is about this week is trying to replace bad cycles of perpetuation of the status quo with a good cycle. And so when I worked with community groups in Chicago, we looked at how do we find a new cycle that will perpetuate itself, that will build on strengths, and that will be appropriate to intervene and break out at different points in the cycle. I'm looking at you because we're going to talk about different points of the cycle today. I'm sorry, what's your name again? What's your name, Pastor Schmidt?
Me? You're looking at me?
Yeah, I'm looking at you, yeah.
Okay.
What's your name?
Peter.
Peter. Peter asked me the other day when at the class, was there an appropriate point in that cycle to break out? Now I'm going to talk about that, okay? I'm finally answering your question from Monday. Okay, so here's a positive cycle, and it's not the only one, but it's one that we might think of as a way of dealing with breaking out of a cycle of change, okay? So then we start up here. Every community is different. We build on assets, like we talked about yesterday, in asset-based community development. Then once we know our assets, we're in a position to deal as partners with the banks and the insurance agencies and the real estate agencies and the ELCA and the other institutions outside. So we can leverage those outside resources to partner with us in the local plans. And here we're going to empower housing to empower residents to connect to housing and other assets. This happened to be a graphic that I did for a housing effort. Housing has a lot to do with place, but it could be any asset. So that could be to connect to housing, to own housing, to develop co-ops, to do a Habitat for Humanity thing, that sort of thing. Then down here we have internal changes that come about. And instead of having all rich people or all poor people, income diversity is a strength. Ensuring access to housing for low-income residents. So always being sure that some low-income residents can afford to live some of the can afford to own, rent, or otherwise access some of the housing in a community. Building human capacities, building that social capital, building institutions, churches, associations, political organizations, and so forth. Developing schools, safety, and transportation to make housing attractive to everyone and avoid coercive development. In other words, don't just build a new enclave inside this slum with walls around it and the people send their kids to private schools, but make the whole community attractive so that people of different incomes will all feel that it's safe, it's a good place to send your kids to school, and so forth. Okay. Having made that internal change, then it's appropriate for external change to come about. You're demonstrating the successes of housing justice and income diversity. That's rubbing off on other folks. It's telling the banks and insurance companies it's possible. You're building partnerships and alliances outside the community, and you're advocating for larger policies and resources which make development successful. So instead of reacting to the car or reacting to mass migration from the suburbs, we are making that external change by showing people how it can be done in a different way. All right, so that's one positive example. Then I'm going to talk about specific things because that's pretty theoretical, right? So let's talk about what specific things might be done to break out of one cycle into the other. Okay, so here's the two cycles. Can everybody see that? Now the way I've done it is I'm showing spinning out of this cycle into this one at these different layers. Okay? So you said, at what point in the cycle can we intervene? And the answer is we can intervene at any point in the cycle. We just need an appropriate strategy. We need to understand what the cycle is. What we learned from the physicists and the chemists and the artists and the family therapists and the nurses and so forth is that cycles that perpetuate the status quo are really powerful. And the way you have to combat that power is to build a new cycle which perpetuates itself as well, in a positive cycle. So there's a way to break out of here. Here, at the point when there was environmental change and we had lost investment and fearful intolerance, we could organize at that point. We could organize opposition and creative adaptation. There are communities in Chicago, Oak Park, Southwest Side, and so forth, where there is racial change going on right now. Having been through this before, good thinking, progressive people, and not necessarily people who you would think would be good progressive folks, organize to say, look, stay here. Stay here. We can afford a mix. We like a mix. Just because Hispanics are coming today or African Americans are coming, we're going to value that as a benefit to our community. We're going to say, look, we can share culture and experience. And what can we learn as the Irish who came here and had an ethnic identity and a culture, and how much do we keep and how much do we lose to mainstreaming? What can we share and learn from that from the Hispanics who come here, for example? So we can adapt. And so they do a lot of basically marketing and education and trying to build home ownership as a strategy. Here we go, at this point in the cycle, economic and social disinvestment is happening, you're losing capital. Here's where you can have a strategy of reinvestment and controlling land. When it's on the downside of the cycle, as a strategy, what you can do is acquire property. It's going down, right? Instead of being suckered on the upside of the cycle, buy low at that point. And that's when you start to build co-ops, and that's when you start to build community land trusts, and that's when you start to have community gardens, and that's when you reinvest in churches and try to build the status of churches. Yeah.
Do you want a strategy ideas that are working around the country at different points?
Let's do that, but let me finish this. And in fact, what I want to do is break into two groups and have strategy ideas. But go ahead, hit me.
Well, one thing that's happening in Duluth, where I live, is like 82,000 and has an inner city. And what has happened, one of the assets is the medical medical employers are in that area. And they
live there. They tend to live there.
I mean
the businesses, the employers. Okay.
And what they've done is formed a partnership with the banks to give very good rates to the employees of the hospitals to buy homes there, because it's to the self-interest of the hospitals in a climate like Duluth, Minnesota, with hills and snow, to have their employees able to walk to work.
Walk to work. Good.
And so they have now a big pool of money that the hospitals have put in and worked with the banks, maybe meeting their CRA requirements to have community reinvestment lending. And people are being offered really good rates to buy homes in the neighborhood right around the
So that's the strategy. Before we get to this, let's spin out into
and
this.
And make it a more diverse neighborhood.
They build partnerships
fairly diverse,
to control assets for the community instead of in that boom and bust cycle. Any other examples like that? Yeah.
Well, I guess the question I have is how we can look at this without looking, you know, more globally. You know, because when you talk about disinvestment, what I think about is, well, the industries that were in Chicago, they're
steel
gone.
Steel mills. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. Then you think about, you know, the people who are, you know, the poor and the low income.
Good.
Well, when that tipping occurs, what happens when there's no longer those industries? Here we're talking Duluth, where probably they're professional and educated folks who are more privileged than those who are poor. So I think about when that tipping occurs, well, then if you don't have a job, then you immediately go to slum.
Sure. So there can be a massive external change from the point of view of this system, external, like the steel industry has changed, right? And that can be the thing that creates this kind of a shock up at this point, right? And so then, what is the local system doing compared to that? And in fact, we're always reactive to these large environmental changes. And part of my thinking is to stop thinking of ourselves as reactive to larger environmental changes and to start to think of ourselves as creating those changes. So when we do, let me just finish this, because the economic development is something I do a lot about. And what we do is we try to get together with business leaders, community folk, try to get together with business leaders and investors and bankers and so forth, and try to do our own industry analysis. Don't wait for the steel mills to mess up. They blew it. Right? They didn't see global change coming. Why don't we look ahead? They're too busy worrying about next quarter's financial statement, right? Why don't we figure out where global industry is heading and figure out how that fits with our local assets and our school systems and our and entrepreneurial opportunities? And can we create a network of self-employed entrepreneurs or something in a particular industry? And now, you know what? There's some really successful steel mills in Chicago. They're mini mills. And this is where it went, you know? And we could have figured that out back then. We could have had worker-owned mini mills in Southeast Chicago if we had spun out to that part of the cycle. Yes, sir. He's raised.
Just an observation, not to anticipate anything earlier, but I've noticed over the years that the word public is becoming more and more pejorative.
Yeah.
Public schools are kind of on the defensive. And it used to be called a common school, which has a, you know, it's really more, or, you know, public housing.
Right.
You know, we're sort of using that word public in a bad way now. I mean, people have that, or public transportation is for the other people, not for, you see, in these common transportation. So, you know, it's just an observation I've made, and it kind of applies to a lot of things you're talking about here.
Yeah, I got to pull this up to do this. What both of you all are saying is what we talked about in first session, but the whole point of part of this cycles thing is scope. OK? Okay? So one of the things is that when we see a self-reinforcing cycle, it seems so powerful at that level. What if we broaden or narrow the scope? Okay, so right here I did it. I said public money came in from outside at the point of gentrification. Whose money is it? It's ours, right? In fact, it's more of the people who live there put more of that tax money in than the people who are gonna move there. Well, it's not their money, they moved from somewhere else. So broadening and narrowing, sometimes it's narrowing. And we use examples from nature and science. An earthquake seems like a big cataclysmic event. Talk about a spark, right? The walls fell in. But Tom is talking about plate tectonics, and bubbling magma, and he's looking at a cycle, right? And for him, then, earthquakes are just a part of that cycle. And then it starts to become manageable because we start to think about what that cycle might be. The government can be within our scope, right? So is public us or is it them? Is it inside our system or is it outside? When people use it pejoratively, they're always saying them. The government is taking my money, right? The government is spending this money over here as an external kind of an agent. If instead we start to look at it, then we start to organize a new party, right? And then we start to say, well, how do we start to look at public investment as a part of our strategy? And now we get to things like this disinvestment part of this here. So here, in gentrification, for example, there's massive public subsidy going on. Are they going to build private housing with public money? Are they going to build enclaves with walls around them? Are they going to build public schools specifically for these folks who have now moved into this community because they say we can't attract people to live here with the schools we got here now because they're terrible, right? Well, why don't we fix up the schools we got here now, right? Why don't we take back the public in public schools and use that to create people-powered regulations and to channel the money for that community? And so that's an appropriate strategy in the upswing of that. But broadening or narrowing the scope gives you the perspective that you need to be able to understand the cycle and figure out a strategy for changing it, which is what we're going to do here. Later on this morning. Let me just say here that the thing on this last end of the scale is breaking out here, open housing and economic links, so that once a community, a lot of people think the best time to intervene in neighborhood change is when the joke in Chicago is that a mixed income community in Chicago is the 2 weeks between the time that the African American moved out and the last white person moved out and the first African American moved in. But that might be an opportunity to say, stop. We all have a common interest right now in this mixed community, right? And we don't have to kick out the folks who live here now. And yeah, there might be some differences in culture and differences in how we think about where we're gonna live. But what we'll do is we'll encourage open housing. We'll encourage economic links between the poor, the rich, and the privileged, and the underprivileged within this community that we live in now. We'll do the walk to work thing to encourage people to stay. And then maybe they'll all be on the same softball team together, and maybe they'll have other kinds of social exchange.
And we should point out that an awful lot of those people are low-income people, because when you think in hospitals, you've got the custodians you have. So it encourages low-income home ownership, too. So there's another goal.
All right, I'm moving fast here. I know that because I always run out of time. But let me just say here, thinking about these strategies, the ones that move out from one cycle to another, and thinking about art and science as well as community economic development or otherwise, I started to break down these strategies into different types. Now you guys can't see. The easy one to think about is external versus internal, okay? So where does the spark for change come from, okay? Now one way to do it is to have external spark for change. So the forest is a natural ecosystem and cycles and a life cycle. The tree of life is a life cycle. that perpetuates itself over time. And if somebody comes along with an axe and chops it down, that's an external source of change. If somebody comes along with a match up here in the forest and burns it down, that's an external source of change. Okay? Doesn't mean necessarily good or bad, but it is from the outside of the system what the scientists say is exogenous. Okay, an internal source of change would be something that comes from within. A good one I use is the Oxbow River. You know what an Oxbow River is? It's just a river that goes through an open field, and it carves its circuitous route through the current. The current is the strength of the system, and that's how it determines what direction it goes. What if you wanted to change the direction? Well, you could have come in and build a dam from outside. That'd be an external change. But you know, there's an internal source of change, and it carves out this loop, right? And then it eats away at this, eats away until it cuts through like that. Now it's got a new direction from an internal source. It changed its direction like that. Yes, sir.
And regarding external change, is it possible or has it been done to go back to our own roots in America to where we've had land acts and so forth, the railroad, you know, building the railroads, they actually set aside land to be sold for the railroad and also land set aside for the common school.
Right, and, good examples.
And I can't, you know, when you had that point where you break out where you control land and at the low point.
Right.
Wouldn't that be possible to say a certain portion is going to be sold for private use maybe, but it's going to have to be used for a new public school or, you know, a new school area or a new...
Or a new housing.
Or transportation or something that will enhance, like you want a railroads are going to build towns and so forth. Maybe this is using, but it's our root... A rooted way, American way of doing it, and it can serve the common purpose, it seems. But maybe this has been done, and I don't know if
it has. But let's talk about it. Both the school thing and the railroad thing were done when the country was settled mostly by those Native Americans, right? And so there was, according to the system as viewed by the United States government, open land, right? And so then they said, well, every 16th?
I thought it was, I'm not sure.
You know what I'm talking about? Every 8 by 8 acre, and then 1/16th of it would be for public schools. This is what he's talking about. So when they talk about a land grant university, that's from that, and public schools would be on that place. Okay. And then railroads, the eminent domain, and just granting to railroads in order to use transportation as a spark for development, then you'd set aside that land. Well, here in the city, you already got this. Now, as a rural strategy, there's a lot to it. Here, everybody's already claiming the land. Yeah. So then, you've either got to use the public, the power of eminent domain to take land away from folks, or use the strategy, according to the cycle, to acquire land when it's cheapest, okay? Both things have happened. Community land trusts. Is a way to try to acquire land for a public purpose in perpetuity, especially in changing urban communities, although the same structure has been used to preserve open space in other places. I mean, so that's more like what you're talking about. And what they do is basically they buy land when it's cheap here, when it's abandoned, taxes haven't been paid for years. There are programs in Chicago that I used to run that were about tax reactivation. It allowed nonprofit community groups to buy abandoned buildings just for paying the back taxes on it, or even without the back taxes, just to get it back on the tax rolls and then to acquire it. Most of that then would be used for affordable housing or for open space, not for schools or for railroads. The point of that would be then that that's how we protect the mixed part. We know this is going to happen. The upper income housing is going to take care of itself. So what we need to do is build in the lower income housing in perpetuity so that there will always be a place for lower income folks to get here. And they can do that as a private development strategy of a community organization. Now, in Boston, the Dudley Street Neighbor Initiative used a similar strategy, and actually the city adopted it as their own. So public and private and community became the same thing. They did such strong organizing and planning that they were able to get the city to essentially turn over to this community land trust all the vacant land in the community that the city had picked up through tax delinquency. And so those are strategies. I didn't talk about the rural open space thing. Yes?
And I think you just answered my question about community and getting leadership. In our micropolitan town of Mankato, the southeast corner is kind of an interesting neighbor. That's where I live. And in the 70s, the airport was just moved further out of town. And there we opened up all this land. The city, whoever was on the city council then, because they created a mixed, they planned mixed neighborhood. And so we have city-owned duplex housing where low-income people can, and then next door is a, you know, $125,000 house. Now, it used to be only $80,000, but now, in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, there's also, on one edge of that neighborhood is the university, and the other edge, the other corner is low-income housing, you know, for the county commissioners did that. So it's an interesting neighborhood. And then there's a farm on the east side, organic farm.
Mm.
And that's where the township begins. Pardon me?
What's protecting that?
It's going to have to be a community contribution to protect that farm so that it's not annexed to the city. That's the big challenge in our neighborhood. You know, what's going to happen to Katie's farm?
Right. Right, and moving outside of the urban thing. Yeah, go ahead and let me do that.
I was just going to say another point of interaction in that is the government's power to negotiate with developers.
Yes.
And right now Minneapolis is doing a lot of development along the riverfront, and there's a lot of negotiation going on. The only way that developers will be able to develop that area is, and I think that's probably what worked in this neighborhood in Mankato too, the only way to develop is if the government says you must set aside this much for open space, this much for low-income housing, this much. In Minneapolis, there's a lot of negotiation going on right now.
And I fear for the community in this neighborhood because of some of the way the city council has been making decisions.
That farm is on the fringe. And that's where the sprawl happens, right? Why does sprawl happen on the fringe? The one we didn't do here is, anybody ever watched The Price is Right? TV show, right? Okay, Bob Barker and all that, right? So then, and the deal is you have to guess the price of something without going over.
Right?
Is that the deal? Okay. So now you think the washing machine costs $500. And the person next to you bid $400. What's your bid?
$491.
Huh?
$491.
Wrong.
$401.
$401. Okay. Person next to you bid $400. You're the last bidder, let's say.
Well, I think you said $491 or something.
Oh, okay. All right. So they're at $400. You think it's $500. Do you bid $490? Do you bid $500? No. You bid $401. The farm right next to town. The land right across the street from the city limits. Where are the malls? Chicago, Evergreen Park Mall.
Yeah.
Right? That's where it is. In every place. In Mankato, I bet. Right? Why? Taxes are lower. Right? Utilities are lower. Blah, blah, blah. That little town will be glad to give us a tax break to put this big job thing in here. So this is the source of sprawl. And whenever I hear people say urban sprawl, I'm urbanness is this. Right? This urbanness is concentration. It's the opposite of sprawl. Ruralness isn't sprawl either. Ruralness is being spread out. Sprawl is trying to be close to both of these things without being part of either. That's sprawl. And that's what's happening all the time. That's 45% of our population. Okay? So we've got cycles of change in urban areas, and I didn't talk about rural areas young people leaving town, the concentration of the family farms into large farms, the drop in population, the aging of the population, the loss of rural assets and resources, and the combination, who was saying, into rural regional centers. The Corps ain't doing badly. We're a rural regional center. We're an hour. We're in the middle of nowhere. So we're all right. Right? We're an hour from Rochester and an hour from La Crosse, from the micropolitan, right? And so we're doing okay. It's Ridgeway that's hurting. It's Kalmar that's hurting. These small towns around it that don't have the Walmart. That's my 5 minute limit. Okay, so what we need to do is figure out strategies for breaking out of this cycle. And to me, when you say that, what you mean is we need strategies to strengthen urban and rural areas, so aren't we really in common? And in fact, I would say the suburbs aren't really benefiting from this either, because just like Herod's tax collectors, they suffer from the exploitation that's a part of their system in the first place. So maybe we ought to be like that guy in Luke and opt out of that system and stop having sprawl, start reinvesting in places here and here, and changing that whole system. So, four ways of doing that: internal, external, and then there are two alternatives here. Diverting a system, which means acting on its weaknesses, and co-opting a system. That was you, wasn't it? Saying, what about co-opting a system, right? See, I remember everybody. Co-opting a system, acting on a system's strength. This is what we're used to. Diverting a system, your big brother will come in and beat up that bully, right? That's diverting a system from outside. The United States will come in and stop the bad Serbs and the bad Kosovars, and we'll straighten everything out. Okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to act on the weakness of that system. We're stronger than them, so they're weaker than us, so we're going to act on that. The opposite of that, I couldn't think of anything else but judo. You use your opponent's weight and action against them and flip it over. Well, so I give examples of that. Internally, though, there's revolution and this is reform. Sorry. Revolution and reform. Inside the system, we'll have a internal initiative which uses the strength of the system to move it in a new direction, like the Oxbow River. Outside the system, we're just going to try to get out of that whole basis of economy. So this is in the Bible study this morning, the guy who gave back the interest that he was charging people. I don't know if you all weren't here. The parable was of the story of the manager of the master's accounts who's going to be fired, and in order so that he will have friends and a place to live and people who will welcome into their home, he calls him back in and says, all that profit I was going to charge you, wipe it off the accounts. He opted out of the system of profit and speculation, just like this system in the urban city, right? So that's kind of like a community land trust or a limited equity co-op. These are projects that acquire land and buildings for low-income people to live in, and then don't ever allow appreciation in the value of the real estate to accrue. You are not allowed to sell it for whatever the market will bear. You can only sell it for what you put into it plus a small amount of regular interest. We haven't given that up. Okay. But not speculative profit like what happens in a gentrifying community. Okay, so that's this, and that's revolution because, I don't know, that's just the word I use for it. It's internal, it's coming from within, but it's buying out of the system altogether. It's acting on the system's weaknesses to move out of it. Now, what if instead you said, what we're going to do is try to increase home ownership in this community, right? So that low-income people who own homes in the slum, when it becomes gentrified, will become not so low-income people. Because they'll own appreciated property. This is a legitimate strategy, too. And actually, sometimes you get big fights in the community economic development movement between these two folks. Because they'll say, these people will say, so if they're just market rate, they get to sell their home for whatever it's worth. And then they'll say, these people will say, but then what about the next low-income people? That benefits these people here today, but what about tomorrow's folks? And these folks will say, well, that's what you white people say. They'll say,
Well, you get market rate stuff, right? You get to have appreciation. Isn't that the American dream? Own a home and use the value of that to pay for your retirement? Which one's right?
Both.
I think they should do both. Up here, Judo, a social loan fund. So we're outside the system, and what we want to do is invest in people's ability to buy homes or to start businesses and entrepreneurship. So that's a kind of a Judo thing. We're going to use the market as a way of trying to uplift people to create wealth and so forth, but we're going to bring in the resources from outside. And here's Habitat for Humanity, which says no interest, and that people aren't going to be able to sell it for more than, you know, what the market bears. But you were telling me, depending on the affiliate,
yeah,
it could be a 10-year limit.
There's a mixture. Yeah, it isn't. Habitat sometimes has discussions with the land trust because we allow the people to, after 10 years, have the appreciation on their property.
Which one is asset-based community development in that matrix? Who was here yesterday?
Right. Social loan fund, probably.
Give me the name of the thing. So in other words, you think it's Judo?
Social loan.
ABCD. Asset-based community development, where the people in the community use their own assets to create opportunities for themselves based on some of the same kinds of business and development models that outside resources would take advantage of. This one, which I didn't even write down, you're so good.
Wouldn't the best strategy be to have all of these things going on at once?
Yeah, okay, very clear. I want it to be clear. I'm not prescribing, I'm describing. Okay, I'm not saying one of these things is right. Asset-based community development, I think, would be down here. Okay, and it was powerful, and it has moved through the country. And boy, you can't pick up a foundation guidelines today without saying you must invest in the assets and capacities of the people living in your community. So it's down here, and they kind of moved from here to here. And that was a powerful move, and so you learn from that. But that doesn't mean it's the only thing. I think all four of these things are appropriate, and I think it might depend on what stage you're at in the cycle and what your scope is, whether it's global, local, both. Right? And so what I like to do is play with all these things. And as much as anything, it's about perspective. It's about where you see yourself and what kind of approach you and the people who you connect with might want to do. And that's where I see the chance for cross integration. That we all know that we can make change in systems, because we've done it. We've made change in our families, or we've been a part of that school board election that turned the school system around, or we've been a part of a forest fire, or we've seen change in a substance abuse situation, for example. And by learning that, we can learn that you can make change, and that creates hope. And the biggest cycle, to me, is the cycle that hope can create action, and action can create hope, so that each of us learning these kinds of strategies for change in our own lives becomes a model for others, a support for others, and then a part of a larger effort to make change wherever we sit. The community organizing thing is, where you sit is where you stand. And so we can all stand where we're sitting, and we can all make change, and try to use these kinds of concepts just to strategize about where they might be. My time is up. I'd be happy to. I can't stay because I gotta go do dishes. But I'll talk to you anytime I'm around today or tomorrow. Thanks for your participation.